Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
組織の幹部だ。250万、あとは契約を履行した時その男が渡す。殺し屋ナンバー3にランクされている君の腕次第だ。
恐ろしい男よ、私のハズ。
殺してもらいたい外人がいるの。場所はもう借りておいたわ。
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me is my intrepid co-host, Mr. Rob St. Mary.
Come on, make with the rice. Pronto.
We're also joined this week by a pair of fellow podcasters from outside the cinema. It's Mr. Bill Byforce.
I'm going to take a number two on you.
And from the V-Cinema podcast, it's our old pal, Coffin John.
I am number one when it comes to number twos.
You have a lot of bran in your diet. This week, we'll be looking at Branded to Kill, or Bran to Kill, I suppose. Perhaps one of the most unusual Yakuza films ever made, Branded to Kill, released in 1967, stars Joe Shishido as Goro Hanada, the number three killer in Japan. He makes his way up to number two, and all hell breaks loose as the Phantom Number One torments him. Along the way, Goro also has problems with his wife, his mistress, and his penchant for boiled rice. So I want you guys to know that I did a ton of research on this movie this week so that, you know, I sound very professional. I got all of the books out of my library by Thomas Weiser so I can tell you guys everything that you need to know about this. First off, I wanted to let you know that Japan is actually a small island off the coast of Florida. So I want to know your experiences with this film. John, let's go ahead and start with you, sir.
Well, I guess my experience with the film was back in, I believe it was like around the mid-90s or so. You know, Seiji Suzuki's films started to become a little more known. I don't want to say prominent. They weren't yet. I think they were just in some selected retrospectives. In the late 90s, as I've mentioned in my my visit with you guys on the Battle Royale episode, in the late 90s, I moved over to Japan. You know, since I'd heard about Suzuki a little bit, I just wanted to see what his films were all about because, you know, I heard that, you know, maybe they'd be interesting for me because I was, I still am into film noir. Branded to Kill wasn't the first of his films I had seen, but it was one of the ones that definitely stood out. And it didn't surprise me that probably about a year or two later, film came out here in the U.S. on VHS, because to me it seemed like it would be a natural fit for you know, us cult film lovers to have access to this film. And so, you know, from there, of course, I've watched a bunch of our Suzuki's films. You know, you try to get an idea of what the filmmaker's like and, you know, how the film fits into his overall, filmography.
Well, I guess my first engine Suzuki experience was actually Tokyo Drifter, which was recommended to me by actually a number of different people. They were just like, oh, if you're looking to get into, you know, some, you know, little, deeper cuts for, you know, Japanese cinema that isn't, you know, as well known in the States. And just like John said, you know, back in the late 90s and even the early 2000s, his stuff was only kind of really just starting to get, you know, watchable releases in the States. And luckily Criterion picked up a number of his titles. And Tokyo Drifter was actually the first one that I picked up because everyone was like, it's nothing like you would expect a Yakuza, you know, Japanese crime film to be. It's just this crazy blast of near nonsensical stuff that hits all the right spots as you watch it. So Branded to Kill is actually the second of his films that I picked up, because a lot of people told me it goes really well with Tokyo Drifter, and we could probably get into that a little bit more later on. But I watched it once probably, and really actually not that long ago, probably only maybe 5 or 6 years ago was when I actually started to get into some of his stuff. And I don't have, you know, the deep pockets and some of his, you know, more difficult to find stuff, more of the stuff that's easy to get, the stuff that was put out in Criterion, like Youth of the Beast and these two films. You know, he's a director that I find immensely interesting. I think his history is almost as interesting, if not more interesting, than some of the films, because some of the films I think get a little crazy, as we'll get into that later on, I'm sure. But it's just a fascinating, you know, time period, I think, filmmaking in Japan. And, you know, this is a really good film to, I'm not going to say, you know, how I feel about the film, but I think it's a really good film to definitely kind of bounce off of to get to other things.
I gotta echo Bill here. I mean, it was Tokyo Drifter is where I came in, and it was with the Criterion releases. And then a few years ago, probably the nicest gift I ever got from my now ex-wife was she bought me the Nakatsu Noir box, which also includes several other Yakuza and crime films from Japan. And there's a Suzuki film in there, the Take Aim at the Police Van, and that one's pretty good too. So that got me an idea to go out and see some of the other stuff. So Youth of the Beast and things like that. Have to say that Branded to Kill, I like it, but it doesn't flow as well for me as Tokyo Drifter. That's the one that I really go back to and enjoy quite a bit.
I'd agree with that.
Definitely Branded to Kill has very distinct sections to it. And as I was rewatching it again, it's like, I can remember so many different parts to it, and I thought that they were a lot closer together, but really the acts are very distinct as far as like almost little adventures that he's going on in the film. Like the first part, we start with him coming back into Japan and getting an assignment and having to escort this guy, and that's kind of what kicks everything off. We have him protecting this dude, and he's kind of been partnered up with this like real loose cannon guy. I mean, who's like drinking and involved with women, and he's just really like there's that part where they're out on the road and this guy's like jumping around. He looks like a damn anime character, just like, you know, ha-da-da, ha-da-da, you know, it's going nuts. That's when the number two killer meets his end. And then we have the section with our main character and this crazy girl who kind of comes out of the rain or stops jobs for him, and she's very associated with rain and dead birds and butterflies, and you have this whole section there, and then we get into the whole section where we have him being tormented by the Phantom Number One, almost like chapters in this one. What draws you guys back to this film, if at all? It sounds like maybe we should have talked about Tokyo Drifter instead.
I think what really draws me to the film is, of course, you know, the imagery is very striking in it. As you mentioned, you know, the scenes that actually you went through are the ones that are very distinct within the film. You know, there's the escort scene. There's the, you know, there's the woman, what's it, Misako, you know, how she's, you know, she comes out of the rain and she sort of becomes this, like, almost like a guardian angel or a savior of some sorts. Like, at least in that one scene, you know, we have this sort of like almost like a holy figure, you know, who he believes maybe has come to save him or something like that, but ends up being, of course, quite the opposite. You know, there's just these really distinct images, I think, in the film that really stand out, which is why, actually, you know, I do like Tokyo Drifter. And actually, on my podcast, we covered the film one time. I think it was episode 41. And I kind of see these films as being almost like they complement each other in a way, because, as you know, Tokyo Drifter was produced before Branded to Kill. And Tokyo Drifter was kind of the film that, you know, Nikatsu had its ends with Suzuki, and basically gave him an ultimatum and said, you know, you have to make a coherent film or, you know, you better hit the road, you know, that kind of thing. And I really kind of feel like with Branded to Kill, he was trying to make this really serious, you know, kind of noirish, you know, atmospheric type of film. But, you know, there's enough of his style in there that, you know, you can tell it's him. So in a way, I kind of feel like he tried, but then sort of in a way failed, you know, which is kind of strange because, you know, Suzuki is sort of usually held up as this kind of like rebel auteur, you know. But in a way, I kind of felt that, you know, I'm just wondering how much he really put into Branded to Kill as being sort of like the film that he hoped could save his job, but in the end didn't.
One of the things I wanted to ask you, and John, you know, much more well-versed in Japanese cinema of that era than I would be, is I was amazed at the amount of nudity in the film. And I was just sort of like, this is pretty amazing that he has basically everybody's naked and they're really artly shot. And I mean, I know that there's a thing, and I think it comes later in the 70s where you get into sort of like softcore and things like that in Japan. Mm-hmm. But that had to be pretty risque at the time, correct?
Yeah, I was kind of shocked too, and I sort of remember maybe the first time I saw this film, or one edition I saw of the film, was a little bit more cut or edited, I should say, excuse me. I'm not too sure if that's just something in my memory or, you know, if that's real. But this time watching the film, I was sort of a little amazed. But at the time, also, you have to remember, this was the era of the Japanese New Wave. And a lot of those films feature a lot of nudity in them, too. And part of the nudity was, you know, it was a kind of a political statement, you know, the sort of like anti-censorship, anti, you know, conservative ideals type of statement. I don't think it's that case with Branded to Kill. I kind of feel it's more for the titillation type purposes.
Nikatsu is not a studio known for its new wave films. We should probably put that out there. Sure. I mean, you know, you've got your Teriyamas and your Oshimas and all these different guys, and they are not doing what Suzuki is doing. And a lot of these guys are not even, well, I want to say maybe Oshima was kind of classically trained and went through the whole idea of the being a student to an older director and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, Suzuki was very traditional when it came to this, you know, like working his way up through the studio and doing everything that a young director is supposed to do, but then just kind of peppering some of these unusual touches through his films until, yeah, really culminates with Tokyo Drifter and Branded to Kill, at least for me. I mean, I know that there are moments earlier in his body of work where it's just like, what the hell is going on? Like in Fighting Elegy, when you've got the guy playing a love song to his girlfriend with his penis, it's just like, what? And some of those color splashes, like in Kanto Wanderer and stuff, and just, you know, little touches here and there. But yeah, stuff really just is unhinged when it comes to these films towards the later part of the 60s. And yeah, you're right. We're right there with the Japanese New Wave has really started to take off at this point. And we've got the events of 1968 are right around the corner, where we've got protests and, you know, the whole student movement is going to happen. And just, we can't really stress enough how much of a tumultuous time it is all around the world. But, you know, when we talk, May 68 is synonymous with Paris, but also there were so many things going on in 68 in Japan as well.
Stop trying to make me learn.
Think, Bill. Think.
One of the things with Suzuki, my understanding of him is that he was a guy who was hired, and he was a program picture guy. I mean, he was like just hired by the studio and he would make these movies. And my whole question is that what was the difference between, say, the original concept for things like Tokyo Drifter and Branded to Kill, and then what he did when he grabbed it and wrestled it to the ground and shoved it through the lens of the camera?
Well, I think not only did he start off as a program picture director, but he originally started with Shochiku. I think we had already alluded to that a little bit. And Shochiku is really kind of one of the more, I guess they are sort of characterized as being sort of conservative, you know, mainly I think because Ozu came from Shochiku. You know, when he moved to Nikatsu was a different kind of studio. It was more of a commercial type studio. And then, as you said, he was a program film director. He was not only a program film director, but his films would be featured on as the second film in a double feature. And the second film in a double feature in Japan is usually the worst one, the worst of the two, excuse me. So, you know, he would kind of already start off as being this sort of like kick to the side sort of director, sort of like ignored in a way, you know, made an outcast to begin with. And I think he sort of tried to find his own style through that and through some, you know, like-minded people who he was hanging around with at that time. You know, not only making pictures that, you know, followed the studio creed because he was essentially given scripts to shoot, but also to, as you know, he says in several of his interviews, to make them entertaining and fun for both him as well as the audience.
You know, it's the thing, once again, when I think about it, as you were saying, you know, basically he was a B-movie director at the studio. He was making the cheaper film that they really didn't care about as long as it came in on budget. More and more, as I think about the films that I enjoy throughout my life, it always seems to be the stuff that, it's not the big high-gloss film, it's always sort of the, for lack of a better term, the crap that everyone's like, oh, well, nobody expected that to be of any value. And now 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years later, we still care about that film, but who cares about the A-list picture?
I also like the whole idea of being put into a situation where you're almost expected to fail, or where you're being given these restrictions. You know, it's kind of like one of my favorite eras in cinema is like Eastern European films under communism. And you have these incredible directors who are trying to get their stories told and are trying to basically subvert the system by telling their story through the oppression of communism. It's almost like the way that we get the messages out via films that were made under the Hays Code, you know, and it's like, you know, there's a lot of subtext going on to these films, and that's what I love. So it's like the studio mandates and all this kind of stuff almost bring out the level of creativity that I really enjoy. So let's talk a little bit about the women in Harada's life. I love the women in this movie. I mean, it's just, we first meet Hanada when he's coming back into town. He's got his wife with him there. And already you know that things are not perfect between these two, especially when she's so disgusted by his dirty habit of enjoying the scent of boiling rice. And then crazy Misako Nakajo. Oh my goodness. Just, I want to know, what do you guys think? Do you think that, and I know this is a weird question, and so since I'm asking a weird question, I'll ask Bill. Do you think that she actually had that butterfly land on the sights of the gun to kind of throw him off?
It's really tough to say, because I feel like, part of me, you know, when you first watch it, you're like, oh wow, you know, what a weird coincidence. But then as like, you kind of think about it and you kind of see how the story unfolds and her kind of weird obsession with dead bugs and like all the kind of just weird stuff that's going around and on around her character. You think that, well, you know, there's something more to this. There wasn't just a happenstance. Is that what I want to use? Let's say coincidence. Coincidence e happenstance that it just happened, you know? So, I mean, her character is, I personally think, probably the most interesting thing in the whole film. And I kind of hate that she gets sucked out of the main plot, like, halfway through it.
Yeah, she gets kind of messed up, too.
Yeah.
I mean, I went back and I read a lot of articles. I mean, all kidding aside with the whole Weiser thing, I read a lot of articles when these films were being re-released. They were being covered in all these different magazines around the U.S. and everything. And it really depended on which writer was talking. Some people were saying that the guy that they escort at the very beginning is the Phantom Number One, and then other people never made that connection. Is that the Phantom Number One at the beginning?
You know, that's kind of a good question, because I kind of thought about that a little bit this last time watching again. When Number One is revealed at the very end, you know, I just, something in the back of my head kind of thought, wait a second, wasn't this guy in the film earlier? And, you know, to tell you the truth, I didn't really think to go back and, you know, just because I didn't really have a whole lot of time. But I didn't really go back to really confirm that. You know, certainly it's the case that there is in the film this kind of thread of, this is the way a killer does it. They say that three or four times. This is my way. This is my, or this is the way of the assassin, you know. And when he says that at the very end to Hanada, you know, he says, you know, this is the way of the killer. You know, you almost kind of think that he's almost been like a puppet master of some sort all along, you know. You know, the first time I watched the film, I didn't really think anything of it. I was just like, oh, it's just some dude, you know. But I have to say that, yeah, that did sort of kind of twinge in the back of my head a little bit, you know. At the same time, you know, I'm not too sure if that's really important to the overall end of the story, because you know, maybe Suzuki put it in there, if he did put it in there, just to be kind of clever. But on the other hand, it could have been just because he couldn't hire another actor. You know, it's hard to say. It's certainly interesting that, at least in the interview, nobody thought to ask him, you know, the interview that's on the DVD, because they asked him some relatively detailed questions about the film, but they never go into that. So I think that might be something that's sort of telling, too.
Yeah, I feel totally racist even asking the question, but I have to say that so many of the people in the film are so distinctive looking. I mean, especially Anna Mari has that kind of great wide nose, and then Joe Shishido, of course, is one of the most distinctive looking Japanese guys ever, with those chipmunk cheeks.
Yep.
She got through plastic surgery, right?
I hope so. I would feel really bad for the guy if those were natural, but still, I mean, it's an interesting choice that you're going to get that done as your plastic surgery.
Well, at the time, I guess it was the full-faced actors were more popular in Japan, and he started off as kind of like a, I guess you'd say a runt, so to speak, kind of a gaunt fella. If, you know, basically, he thought, if I remember the story correctly, he thought, you know, why don't I get these, you know, implants, and, you know, I'll probably get better jobs out of them, you know. But as far as Anne Marie goes, she's actually half Japanese, half Indian. So I'm sure she was cast mainly for her exotic look.
You know, one of the things when I think about this film, and it's the one thing that I remember before I even saw it, someone's like, you got to see this because it's the lead character, you know, obviously Joe Shishida with the chipmunk cheeks, but this whole like rice fetish. And as I was watching it again, I was thinking that maybe it was a satire, because when you talk about Japanese culture and that being like the staple crop, kind of like when you think about Ireland, it's like potatoes, right? So maybe sort of Suzuki is like saying, here is the ultimate Japanese hitman, because not only is he like one of the best hitmen, but he's like so in love with rice, which of course is like the staple, the big thing when we talk about food in Japan. I don't know.
I totally see that. I think they kind of allude to that in that interview that John was talking about, just like, I wanted to make a Japanese hitman, so of course he's going to be all into rice. And I have to say, I don't necessarily know the smell of cooking rice that distinctly. Maybe they should, you know, do like an Odorama card for a Branded to Kill re-release.
Yes,
you know?
I like that. Every time he runs over to the rice cooker, you scratch the card.
Scratch the number, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, one more interesting thing to note is that part of the reason why they added that into the script, I think, was that they got a product placement deal with the company that made that rice cooker.
Oh, nice. So
I'm not too sure if that was after they decided that he would like rice or if it was before, but yeah, and it's very prominent. You can see the brand a couple of times in the film.
You know, I have to say I remembered this film a lot differently because I saw it kind of like John. I saw it in the early to mid 90s on VHS, and I think this was my first Suzuki that I saw. And I wonder if it's one of those things, like, because I prefer this one to Tokyo Drifter. I wonder if it's one of those, like, the first one you see is going to be your favorite, kind of like, you know, Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels versus Snatch kind of thing. But I remember him on that balloon a lot different in my mind than I remembered watching it. I mean, because we have that whole montage of those amazing assassinations. I mean, and then I've gone back and I've seen pictures of him on the balloon, like in those articles I was talking about, but I don't remember seeing it that prominently in the film.
I'm gonna agree with you there. Like I said, I only saw it for the first time a few years back, so I'm probably looking at it a little bit differently. And this is only, I think, the third full time I've actually watched it through. The thing with Branded to Kill that kind of always sticks with me is the music. And that music that's lent in that montage, that kind of like acid jazz, like kind of ambient, but like still upbeat and just kind of like all over the place music that fits, you know, kind of like the chaos that's in that scene. And you can watch that montage probably, I mean, well, I've now watched it three times, but I'm willing to bet you can watch it multiple times and get a different feeling from it every time you watch it. Just because of the type of, you know, the way it's presented. It's presented really scatterbrained and kind of all over the place. So I can totally see why you'll watch it one time and pick up on, you know, this assassination paired with this part. And then another time be like, oh, why is the balloon so, you know, so prominent and this and that? It's, you know, it kind of lends itself to the insanity or genius, if you want to, because it can kind of go either way, you know, of the direction of it. Because it's not ordinary stuff.
Yeah, some of the cuts in the film are just either absolutely bizarre or absolutely wonderful, depending on how you look at it. Like the part at the beginning when the drunk assassin is running down that long, like, I don't want to say it's a corridor. It's like almost like a tunnel. And screaming and going nuts and runs up to the guy and all of a sudden like cut and they're in each other's arms and it's just like, what the hell am I seeing? And it took me so long to figure out what had even happened with it. I don't know. It was almost like a little Godard to me.
That was, I was going to say, is that if you like New Wave and especially Godard, then you would absolutely love Branded to Kill because of the odd sort of juxtapositions, sort of the strange use of narrative, the cuts and things like that. I mean, I think it's great. And then also, I think the lighting in it, too, especially in a lot of, like I was talking about with the nudity and whatnot. There's like this whole thing with them running around and the way he sort of lit it. It's very beautiful. It's very film noir influenced. And just the visuals are great for it just being black and white.
Yeah, I think the fact that it's black and white really lends itself to that because you have really, you know, black blacks and really white whites that kind of almost make some of that stuff almost like kind of like pop right out at you. They wouldn't have that same feeling if it was in color.
Well, which is great because when you look at like Tokyo Drifter and it's like this uber color, you know, that pale blue suit that the main character wears is just so beautifully filmed and everything. And to go from one to the other and yeah, just have that really stark black and white. And I love those moments in Branded to Kill where you get like the on-screen graphics, like the butterflies and the birds and the rain and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, it just stands out so much.
Which is totally like something that you would see out of Godard because when you get to like Weekend or something like that, where he's putting a lot of intertitles in, or things like that. I mean, it's totally an heir to that kind of idea.
When you talk about Seijun Suzuki, of course, you know, the first thing that you talk about is his style as a director. And, you know, certainly, you know, that's a very distinct part of his work. But there were also some people behind the scenes who were helping him out. These were basically like a loose collective of his friends who were also filmmakers and people who worked in film and design and music, etc. In fact, several of them show up in this film in that they helped him produce the film.
particularly his production designer, Takeo Kimura. He is he's a person that a lot of people credit as being sort of like the visual designer of that era as far as Japanese film goes. I mean, Kimura has worked with, you know, not only Suzuki, but also very famous directors, especially so-called subversive film directors such as, you know, Kei Kumai and Yasuharu Hasebe and Tero Ishii and Toshio Masuda, Tomoa Uchida, Yasutaka Abe, all these people who were kind of like in this, you know, not only new wave, but sort of underground film movements that were happening at the time. And Kimura is generally credited as being the person who, you know, did a lot of these really, you know, outlandish set designs. Both Suzuki and Kimura were part of this sort of loose group of friends that were called the Hachiro Guryu. They are actually credited as being the writers of this film. You can even see it at the name of the group is even translated in the English credits on the Criterion disc, which is kind of nice, I guess, if you happen to be a part of them. But these were, you know, a loose group of friends who tried to support Suzuki because, you know, as we all know, Suzuki was kind of being, you know, ostracized and sort of maybe fairly, maybe unfairly, you know, singled out as someone who was not, you know, so-called pulling his weight within the studio. So, you know, a couple more of the people in this group who were kind of prominent in Japanese film were Atsushi Yamatoya, who actually was the person who did the music for Branded to Kill, as well as Yutaka Okada, who kind of became his own, came in his own right as a filmmaker. And Chusei Sone, who's also sort of, you know, again, sort of at the time a little underground, but in Japanese film communities, a pretty well-known name. Actually, you know, not only were these guys responsible for, you know, writing Branded to Kill, but they are also responsible for getting Seijun Suzuki back into the director's chair. As the story goes, you know, Nikatsu fired him after Branded to Kill, and he in turn sued the studio, you know, for the money they lost as well as for his own personal honor. He ended up having to settle, but what happened was he got blacklisted for 10 years. Now, he didn't go completely without filming stuff. He went into TV and he did commercials and instructional videos, basically anything to kind of keep him in the industry, but not, you know, actually doing film. And it was in 1977 where, you know, at the behest of, you know, his seven friends who made up this group, basically he became an independent filmmaker. And then he started up doing, I forget what his first film was. And yeah, 1977 was, oh yeah, Story of Sorrow and Sadness, which is a very unique and interesting film in itself. And then he went on to do like the Taisho trilogy, which is, you know, very well regarded in the art film community. And then, of course, he's done a Pistol Opera, and then what's it called, Princess Raccoon. Since then,
yeah, we'll definitely talk a little bit more about Pistol Opera after we take a break and play back some important messages.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOF at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at adamandeve.com.
All right, I'm here with Bill Byforce and Mr. Chris to tell you a little bit about Outside the Cinema.
All right, Reverend Scott, take us to church.
What can we expect to find from a typical show?
2 hours of just random blabber.
Is there anyone's coattails you rode in on to popularity?
I'm the guy that f***ing burns the coattails and then pisses on them.
You review all these exploitation, horror, comedy, cult, and often all-around terrible movies. You must have a strong driving force that keeps you going.
Ego.
And I don't know if I've heard you say that before.
I've been saying that for a while.
Really?
I have been saying that for a while. Also, I'm high on smack.
Well, it's definitely working for you guys. People are coming out in droves to support you on iTunes.
We just the other day got a one-star review on iTunes.
Well, that is one star too many. Let me tell you, the worst f***ing piece of shit I've ever heard.
This has been great, guys.
Thanks, Scott. That was good. Oh, he's got you crying over there.
I'm good for the rest of the year.
Nice.
That was too much.
GGTMC live for you, fresh yeah. Big Willie and the Samurai are at your service, breaking films down and turning them around, giving recommendations that are always on point. Visit ggtmc.com for more information. The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, bringing class to the trash since 1977.
We're back. We're joined this week by Cuff and John of the V-Cinema Podcast and Bill by Force of Outside the Cinema, talking about Seijun Suzuki's Branded to Kill. And now Suzuki has directed dozens of films, but so far, probably only a handful have actually been available to you legally here in the States. So what other Suzukis have you seen and enjoyed, gentlemen? I want to start with you, Mr. Bill.
Well, we talked a lot about Tokyo Drift earlier on, and that's definitely kind of my go-to Suzuki film. Obviously, this one. And the other one that I've seen I would give a big thumbs up, if you will, Youth of the Beast is the other one. I've seen most of Pistol Opera, Born Fighter I've seen, but I don't remember. And I think Tattooed Life and Youth of the Beast are the only other ones that I've seen completely. So I'm still fairly new to a lot of his stuff. I don't know why I haven't watched more of it, to be honest with you.
You know, Tokyo Drifter for me, it's that I will find myself humming the theme song and trying to sing it in Japanese from time to time, just, you know, waiting for the bus or walking around.
How's that work out for you?
It's good. You know, people avoid me even more than they normally do. But the other thing is, I have to say, go back to this Nukatsu Noir box that I really like, and Take Aim at the Police Van is a great film. It's worth seeing. It's a little more scaled back. It's not as crazy as what you get with something like Tokyo Drifter or definitely Branded to Kill. You see the seeds of a lot of his stuff in there. I mean, it's 1960, but it's definitely worth taking a look at. It was funny because with this episode, Mike had sent me a copy of Pistol Opera to watch, and the subtitles weren't working. And I remember we were talking on Facebook amongst ourselves, and Coffin John was like, just watch it anyway. The subtitles doesn't matter. It's just, you know, the story doesn't really matter, so who cares what they're saying?
Yeah, because I've tried to watch it with the subtitles on quite a few times. It's a hard movie to watch. I don't know if you guys feel the same way, but I have a hard time kind of getting into it.
I'm going to agree with that.
Yeah, it's definitely a film that you have to sort of forget about any kind of story and just enjoy the visuals and the rhythm of the film itself. I have a hard time with that, too. I'm very much a story person. But, you know, if I can just sort of let go of, you know, there's not going to be a story. If I can just let go of that, then I can enjoy it to a degree.
I wonder maybe if I should turn the subtitles off. But I'm always trying to make sense of what I'm seeing. I mean, I've watched a lot of like Hong Kong films without subtitles, and it's fairly, you know, universal language of cinema. So it's like, oh, well, that guy's angry at this guy, and oh, that girl must have seen him doing this, and yada, yada, yada. But there's no making sense of Pistol Opera for me. with or without subtitles, I imagine.
We had mentioned that, you know, not all of his films have been available to the West here. And I think that's kind of there's kind of a reason for that. You know, as we established, he was a program film director and, you know, sort of a B film director, I guess, as we call him. You know, a lot of his older films are really not that good. You know, I mean, they're very, I don't want to say they're terrible, but they're just kind of typical crackerjack sort of Yakuza action films that, you know, on one hand you think, well, I do want to see that. But when you actually see them, because I've seen a few of them, a few of his earlier ones that don't have any subtitles just yet, I'm just sort of like, eh, you're not missing a whole lot. You know, I think when he really starts coming into his own is actually Youth of the Beast. And not surprisingly, that's when he started working more with, you know, as I mentioned, his production designer, Takeo Kimura. But the films of his I really like are the ones that, you know, as I said, you know, I'm very much a story guy. And whenever I watch a Seijun Suzuki film, I have to sort of put in the back of my head, OK, don't expect a story. Don't expect a story. I just go in there trying to appreciate the visuals. But, you know, I would definitely recommend, for example, Gate of Flesh. That's where he starts to really, I think, blossom as far as, you know, using of color, especially. If the use of color, in Tokyo Drifter is what interested you, then I would definitely check out that film. It's also available on Criterion. His other films, I've pretty much seen everything that's on Criterion, as well as items that have been released on Kino International. And some of the old ones, like I said, they're really kind of not that good. But Take Aim at the Police Van, I think, out of those, is surprisingly good. I think it's much better than a lot of the stuff that he put out during that era, as was... actually, I'm going to hesitate to say, as was Underworld Beauty, which was put out by Image Entertainment about maybe 6-7 years ago. That's sort of mediocre. It was kind of it has a lot of atmosphere, but is really not that good of a film overall. If you are hoping that you can see some of these older Suzuki films, you know, there's time that's, you know, maybe better spent elsewhere.
You know, if you want to see other Joshishidu films, speaking of this, I'm going to bring up this box again, this Nukatsu Noir box that Eclipse, which is the Criterion side label, put out. The five films that are on here, three of which have Joshishidu on it, so you can pick that up there. And then we talked about on Battles Without Honor and Humanity, he shows up in at least one of the episodes in that whole series. And of course, yes. I will rave about Battles with Honor and Humanity until they put me in the grave. So definitely watch that one.
Well, if you want to check out more Joe Shishido, check out the Alvin and the Chipmunks movie, The Squeakquel.
I was pretty disappointed when I finally managed to see a subtitled version of Detective Bureau 2-3, Go to Hell Bastards. Since we've got Suzuki and Shishido together, I won't say again because this was earlier than Branded to Kill. And yeah, I was really expecting like a, you know, the earlier version of Branded to Kill, but yeah, it's pretty typical kind of film. I mean, there's some interesting moments here and there, but it's just, it's nowhere near that. But yeah, Branded to Kill, that one in Tokyo Drifter, really, they just, every time I watch them, I pick up new stuff and I just really kind of get off on the use of the music and the visuals and the whole like pop noir new wave, you know, mashing together of all these different things. It's just so much fun. These things have kind of come in waves as far as, you know, video releases, DVD releases, you know, now Blu-ray and everything. And it's like, you know, there's this great well to be, you know, mined of all these different older Yakuza films and Japanese films that just really haven't been available in the US very much at all. And it seemed like for a while there was kind of like a movement trying to get some of these kind of other oddity type things out there, like Black Lizard. When that one came out, that one blew me away as well. And I don't even know if that one's available on DVD now. I just remember it being out on VHS and, you know, like really knocking my socks off. And then the film Velvet Hustler. I don't know if you guys have seen that one, but terrific film. And what was the other one that I'm trying to think of? Black Tight Killers is terrific as well. Do you guys have any other favorites as far as some of these kind of off the wall Japanese gangster films?
I'm a big Pinky Violence guy. So when I go to watch kind of like off the wall Japanese stuff, that's kind of where I, you know, I fall to this, you know, like Sex and Fury, the female prisoner scorpion movies, Delinquent Girl Boss, that type of stuff. And if you really want to get out there, you can watch something like School of the Holy Beast. But my Yakuza background is kind of spotty at best. When I watch Takashi Miike's Yakuza stuff, and then I watch something like Branded to Kill and Tokyo Drifter, I see like a direct correlation of Miike almost biting off a lot of the style used. Am I the only one that picked that up?
I can totally see a direct line, if not a direct line, a very thickly dotted line between the two.
I think you could even say that Suzuki was very influential to anime directors. I mean, as I said, he directed a couple of anime, one anime feature, one of the Lupin the Third full-length films. But I think just, you know, especially if you look at, you know, it seems like we're talking more about Tokyo Drifter than Branded to Kill. But if you look at Tokyo Drifter, there's a lot of scenes there that are very much influenced anime in the use of, you know, colors and, you know, sudden striking moments and scenes, etc. I would say one director, and he has a box set on Criterion, is that dude want to check out is Koryoshi Kurahara. I believe the name of the box set is The Warped World of Koryoshi Kurahara. I think if you're interested in Suzuki, you could almost see Kurahara as like a progenitor of Suzuki style, in that you know, I think that people look at Suzuki and say, oh my God, he was so unique, so individual, his style is so singular, you know, within Japanese film. But Kurahara was doing film before Suzuki, and his style, some of his films are just really off the wall. I can only remember a couple of the films that are available in the box set that are actually more of his more tame type films. But there's one film that's sort of a crime noir of his called Intimidation that's worth seeing. It's not as offbeat as his other works, but I would recommend that. And I think this is a film that maybe I've talked about on another podcast, is Masahiro Shinoda's Pale Flower, which I think you know, if you liked Branded to Kill, you'll probably like Pale Flower a lot. It's also black and white. It's very much a crime Yakuza type of film. Has some very striking imagery, and also some very, you know, light-hearted kind of funny moments to him. So I kind of feel like the two films would almost make a good double feature, at least, you know, thematically and visually speaking.
Yeah, I don't think Shinoda really gets very much due over here, and that is a real shame to me. I mean, for a while there, I was kind of collecting his stuff because he had a great relationship with Terayama, and seeing his adaptations of some of those Terayama scripts and then what he kind of went into with some of his films. And I mean, again, another one that I really wish I could see a good copy of, I mean, I've got a subtitle print, but it is just absolutely garbage, is his version of Demon Pond, which then, kind of to Bill's point, Miike created a Demon Pond version a few years later, you know, 20, 30 years later. So, God, I wish there was a good copy of that. And then I was just looking up, because I was saying that I wasn't sure if Black Lizard was out on DVD in the States. I'm not sure if it is in Japan, but over here, it looks like it's still only on VHS, and it's being sold on Amazon right now for $249.75.
I just remembered the one film you should check out from that director, Koryoshi Kurahara, that's really offbeat, is The Warped Ones. I think it came out here in the U.S. in the 70s as some inane title, like The Lovemaker.
Weird Lovemakers.
Yeah, The Weird Lovemakers, that's it, yeah.
Yeah, Something Weird Video has that out. Like, I want to say it's a dubbed version, I'm not sure.
I remember seeing that version that you're talking about, and then I saw The Warped Ones thinking, oh my God, there's all this stuff that's added in. Yeah, it's definitely worth checking out. Very interesting, to say at least. And that's a 1960 film. That's, you know, almost a decade before stuff like Branded to Kill and Tokyo Drifter.
Probably the weirdest little Japanese film I saw recently that got a nice push, both the theaters and to home video in the States in the past few years, was House. And I absolutely love House.
Ah, yes.
That movie is so out there.
We should do a House episode one of these days.
Yeah.
Ooh, yes.
I think it's the only podcast at this point that hasn't.
Well, then we'll get right on that. That'll be next week. Let's talk about House.
No, we did it too, so I can't.
You know what I think about it, though, when I give it another second or two, and I think about maybe the influence of someone like Seijun Suzuki, I think of maybe Tetsuo or Tokyo Fist. I can't remember the filmmaker off the top of my head, but his kind of stuff.
You're talking about Shinya Tsukamoto, right? The director?
Yeah. And Tokyo Fist is probably 5 years before Fight Club, and to me is probably along the same lines as that.
So we're going to take another break and play a preview from next week's show.
My name is Martin. I'm 84 years old. People think I'm crazy when I tell them how old I am. I'd like to be normal. I just have a sickness. The only way I can survive is by drinking blood. You see, people don't understand what's wrong. They think that I'm a monster. They think I'm a vampire.
Martin, another kind of terror.
I would like to be like everyone else. I have to do things that I don't necessarily like to do. But I want to stay alive. I do need blood.
From the director of Night of the Living Dead,
Martin. That's right, we're back next week with George A. Romero's Martin, A Tale of Vampirism, or maybe not, in Pittsburgh. So I just wanted to ask you guys, what do you got going on with the show these days? We're going to start with you, Mr. Coffin John.
Well, to tell you the truth, the old V's Cinema show is on hiatus right now. It's one of those situations in which life is kind of getting in the way of me doing the show. So if you want to hear back episodes of the show, there are plenty of them. They're about maybe around 50 or so. But we are on hiatus. Hopefully we'll start up again in another 5-6 months or so. But until then, check out vcinemashow.com. We post a lot of not just Japanese, but Asian film reviews and discussions, etc.
Yeah, and if you want to hear John on the show with us, of course, as I alluded to, Battles Without Honor and Humanity episode, and also Battle Royale, two great episodes, so you may want to check those out. And a man who was on with us just recently talking about Raw Force, Bill Byforce, Outside the Cinema. What's going on over there? Kickstarter kicking your butt?
Well, unfortunately, unlike John, I can't let go of my show and take the time to spend with my family. this week will be 270 episodes.
Wow.
Of just the regular Outside the Cinema episodes. We're chugging along. We just finished our big Kickstarter fundraising campaign to help move our studio, because we have to move the studio in the house to another room, and we needed to upgrade some equipment and all that fun stuff. So the next 6 months or so of shows are actually going to be all listener generated content. We've got somewhere in the neighborhood of like 50 something movies of people that donated to our Kickstarter and wanted to, you know, either come on the show and cover a movie with us or just suggest a movie. So I know both you guys are going to be on as part of that. So I owe you a big thank you for that. But I always make sure that I give you guys your due, because the show is awesome and you guys are good dudes. So now that Rob's here, not
if we could throw a few Jerry Lewis jokes in there, we'd be all right. You know what I really like is that, you know, to me, what you guys do over there is really just, you know, hey, let's have a conversation about this thing. And we seem to be a little bit more bookish, which is funny because you're like, you're making my head hurt.
Well, that's how we set out. I mean, one of the things, like, I got nothing against smart podcasts. That's not really my character.
You know, that's the thing that I like, is that you can go, hey, you know, if you want to go make your brain hurt, go listen to the Projection Booth, and they'll have like this week, Last Temptation of Christ, you know, for Easter.
Feel good film of the year right there.
There you go. Mm-hmm.
I got to be silly. Like, I can't be serious. Like, I can't in like short bursts. I mean, I know what I'm talking about. I know my stuff, but like, it's just, we're the morning drive of movie podcast.
Yeah, you're the morning zoo of film podcast. It's good.
Hey, welcome back to OTC, your source for a cult movie discussion. Coming up next, we're going to be talking to Rob St. Mary. You're an awful man.
I try to be. I really do. It's a job that I signed up 4 years ago.
You're like a walking Lynch film, and it makes me angry.
That's the greatest compliment I've received all day.
Did you receive any other compliments today?
Strangely silent.
Anyway, moving on.
Actually, this episode was edited by Seijun Suzuki, so
yeah,
it's a very French New Wave, Nouvelle Vogue podcast.
Every Monday, or I should say every Monday, most Mondays, we broadcast the show live over at tv.outsidethecinema.com through Ustream. 5 o'clock in the East. What's that? 3 o'clock in the West, and sometime next week in Australia. Yeah, no, we're just, you know, we're doing our thing.
But that's why we love you, and that's why we gave you some money on Kickstarter.
Bill, I'm going to pick movies that just kick your ass on there.
Dude, all right, hang on. All right, so let's...
Royal Tenenbaums. And Gummo.
Isn't it sad, though, like, the bottom of the barrel stuff that... I mean, if you don't know Outside the Cinema, we are like the bottom of the barrel of like the cult movie world. We dredge up stuff that was never meant to be found. And but yet then somebody will be like, oh, yeah, why don't you guys cover like a Wes Anderson film? And I'll be, you know, why don't you go fuck yourself? I don't want it.
I don't know who that would torture more, actually, because I couldn't make it through the Royal Tenenbaums or Gummo, so.
It's awful. Give me a third-rate VHS rip of The Guy from Harlem over that any day.
Rumor has it that if I'm on, we're going to talk about Hamburger the Motion Picture.
That's not a rumor. That's confirmed and already downloaded and prepped to go.
I still think you guys should do Hamburger the Motion Picture and Hot Dog the Movie.
It would make for a great title, but other than that, no.
So thanks again, guys, for coming on the show. It's been great to talk to you. I also want to thank everybody out there in podcast land for tuning in. If you want to return the favor for all the free entertainment that we've just given you, get on over to the RondoAwards.com. That's RONDO, not Ronco, like Ronco Records. RondoAwards.com and email in a vote. God, I hate that they don't have a form there to do this, but email in a vote for the projection booth. Voting ends on April 7th, so time is running out.
And remember, it's Best Horror Podcast, and as you heard, Branded to Kill, big horror film.
Wait, hold up. You guys are nominated for Best Horror Podcast?
Best Horror Podcast.
Wow.
Like I said, it was like when Jethro Tull won Best Metal Performance over Metallica.
I knew you guys were nominated. I didn't realize it was as specific as Best Horror Podcast. When was the last time you guys even covered a horror movie? Oh, wait, Last Temptation of Christ.
Well, anyway, if you miss your window in order to support us that way, go over to iTunes. Leave us some feedback, some stars, of course. You know, Bill often raves about the fact that he got one star too many on iTunes. We like 5 stars, so why don't you do that? Also, subscribe to the Cinema Podcast and Outside the Cinema because we like these guys. And, of course, you can go over to projection-booth.com, get all the links to all the fine podcasts and everything that you just heard. Now, guys, if you excuse me, we got some rice to boil, gentlemen.
香水の匂いがした。でっかい指輪をはめてるな。安かねえんだ。安心しろ。そいつには当てねえよ。曲がったネクタイを。 気にして死んだ。寝ぼけ顔の殺し屋は寒そうに震えてた。女を抱いてきたのか。当たり気よ。 湯たんぽを抱きな。熱い鉛を抱いて死んだ。